Good evening, everyone. I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. The International AIDS Conference in Amsterdam just ended this past weekend. New data released at AIDS 2018 revealed a significant $6 billion gap between what is available for the response and what is needed now to ensure global access to prevention, treatment, and care for HIV/AIDS. A report released recently by the United Nations Children's Fund says teenagers, and particularly girls, are bearing the brunt of the global AIDS epidemic, with around 30 adolescents becoming infected with HIV every hour in 2017. On the show today, we will discuss HIV/AIDS, look at progress made and remaining challenges. Joining us in the studio is Chris Collins. He is president of the advocacy group Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria. Chris Collins, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also joining us via phone from Washington, D.C. is Megan E. Davis. Ms. Davis is Chief of Operations and Program and Integration at the Whitman Walker Health, a nonprofit community health center in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Ms. Davis, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Fantastic. It's good to have the both of you. So let me tell our listeners that we will discuss HIV/AIDS in a moment with my guests. But first, I spoke to Ndaba Mandela. He's the grandson of political icon Nelson Mandela and a UNAIDS global ambassador. He elaborates on why it was important for him to get involved in the fight against HIV/AIDS. Take a listen.
Well, first of all, both my parents died of HIV/AIDS. And as you know, this epidemic has ravaged our country and the continent over. And, you know, the stigma of this disease was something that was really killing us because it was not like any other disease that we've ever seen before. It came with a question of morality because if you've contracted HIV/AIDS, you have been engaging in immoral behavior. You understand? You have been sleeping around. You have been not protecting yourself. You have been doing XYZ, which is nasty, which is terrible, which you cannot talk about. You must hide. And so when people contracted this disease, they died in silence. They died alone. They died with shame. So it was important for my grandfather, first of all, when our father died, to disclose that our father, his child, had died from HIV/AIDS. Because up until then, people will always be talking about the other symptoms. He decided that, no, we're not going to talk about TB and pneumonia. We're going to talk about HIV/AIDS. And that was one of the turning points in our country because one of the biggest family, if not the biggest family, had disclosed to the world that HIV/AIDS has taken the life of their own. And so it gave courage to other families to also start talking and fighting the stigma that exists. Through that courage of Madiba, you know, our country has slowly been able to get rid of HIV/AIDS. Obviously, the fight continues. People must not be naive or have any misunderstanding. HIV is still very much alive and kicking, and we need to defeat this disease. I then was asked to be an ambassador of UNAIDS just shortly before the World Cup in South Africa in 2010, and I've been serving ever since. And of course, because I've been a victim of it indirectly, you know, it's a no-brainer that I continue to fight and champion this cause because it also has to do with the rights of minorities, people with different sexualities. You know, it's about discrimination, the very same discrimination we faced during apartheid of South Africa. And I wish many more people can join us in this fight against HIV/AIDS because we want to end discrimination, we want to end the infections, and we want to end the deaths that are related to HIV/AIDS.
And that was UNAIDS Global Ambassador Ndaba Mandela. Chris Collins, and let me have your reaction on what you heard, Ndaba. It touched on so many different issues from stigma, it just touched on so many things. Do you have a reaction?
Well, I think the point is that we need to fight HIV in a very comprehensive way. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, everybody living with HIV should have access to medications that can save their lives. But that's also true for we need to be scaling up availability of prevention services for people. And we need to think about what in the social environment and economic environment makes people vulnerable, either to becoming infected with HIV or not getting the care they need. So for young women, for example, we need to be talking about things like mitigating violence so they're not afraid of being victims of violence. We need to think about women's equality and women increasingly being able to attend school and having economic opportunities. So I think we need to really think holistically about HIV and where people who are affected, their living situations.
That's a good point. And Megan, you work in the Washington, D.C. area, and at some point, Washington, D.C. was said to be very much affected by HIV/AIDS. Give us your assessment on what is happening now in your community.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that talking about the present is also just as important as talking about the past. We keep talking about how what it was and what it was in Africa, what it was in the U.S., and unfortunately, it's what it is, right? And so just as, you know, my colleague mentioned about focusing on young women in D.C. are one of the only groups, young women as well as young men and young MSM, who the rate of HIV is continuing to increase. And so we talk about condoms, we talk about safer sex, we talk about pre-exposure prophylaxis, and these are all incredibly important tools for these young people to have. But we also need to talk about things like self-esteem. And we need to talk about what type of programming we have for these young people to start navigating their relationships, their gender norms, their sexuality. It's Women Walker, where I work in D.C., is really focused on making sure that we do provide that holistic approach, both on the prevention side, and then if you do find yourself HIV positive, how we make sure that you stay healthy and how you help to not infect others.
That's a very, very important point. So what do you, Chris, can you perhaps react to what Megan said in terms of there are so many different aspects. She talked about self-esteem. When we look at HIV/AIDS among young women, what is failing?
What's failing is we're not providing the either the social equality or the healthcare supports that young women need. There's so many ways in which young women in sub-Saharan Africa are vulnerable. Many of them are victims of violence. They don't have equal power within their relationships. They don't have economic equality, so they're dependent on other people and unable to insist on being safe in a sexual encounter. So, you know, I think we need to, again, think about the person and all the supports they need. But remember, too, that the tools we have today are outstanding, and they're just light years ahead of what we had 5-10 years ago in the HIV epidemic. If we can get somebody living with HIV treatment and they can respond effectively, their expected lifeline is just as long as anybody else. We have pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is extremely effective in preventing HIV if you take it daily as a preventive. So we really have great biomedical tools. We need to be thinking about getting those to everyone who needs them and thinking about the context for those people.
That, and Megan, we do have great tools, as Chris mentioned, but how available are there in your clinic? Is it free? Are the services free? Some people talk about the cost of access.
Absolutely, no. The costs are often the biggest issue and the biggest barrier to receiving these services. Mm-hmm. We are very lucky in the District of Columbia at Whitman Walker. We have a website called prepfordc.com where all of these FAQs are. So you, anybody, please log on and you can read all about this. It is either free. We can work with the pharmaceutical companies in order to get the drugs, but also DC does have really great comprehensive insurance. And most young people in the District of Columbia are still on their parents' insurance. And so it's really important to get people when they're young, so 13 to 24 year olds, which is again one of the places where we're seeing an increase in HIV positive rates as well as rates of STIs. And so, you know, like Chris was saying, we need to make sure that we are continuing to have the conversation about violence and, again, self-esteem, like I mentioned before, just as in sub-Saharan Africa, in the District of Columbia, so many girls are walking in and saying that they are survivors of sexual assault or at the hands of loved ones, and they don't know how to navigate that and how to navigate those conversations. And so in addition to the biomedical opportunities that we have, we also make sure that we focus on the behavioral health and work on trauma and make sure that we are having trauma-informed care with these young girls and with everybody. Again, not just girls. We have a ton of, you know, boys that are coming in, gender nonconforming folks, and, you know, we have over 500 patients under the age of 30 that are HIV positive that we're currently taking care of. It's really important that we continue to help them also stay undetectable. Again, like Chris was saying, if someone is undetectable, so they don't, that you cannot see their viral load in a viral load test, then the odds of them transmitting HIV are zero. And so we need to continue that conversation as well so people understand what the real risks of HIV are.
And on the global level, access to the tools, Chris, what can you tell us? Because there are some places where people are having difficulties having access to the basic drugs.
I think the lesson right now, at least globally on HIV, that we're seeing is where we've scaled up access to treatment and prevention and other interventions that we know work, where we've really gotten those to a lot of people, we're seeing tremendous results. So in a lot of places, for example, in Eastern and Southern Africa, you're seeing countries, it just was a story came out of the Amsterdam conference that Namibia is making great progress in terms of getting effective treatment to people. They're going to make their UNAIDS target, actually, or have already made it. So a lot of countries that are scaling and making things available are succeeding. Where we're failing to scale, we're seeing the opposite result. And so the lesson is great tools, they have to be at scale. Otherwise, we're not going to get where we need to get. Many parts of Western Africa, Eastern Europe, Central Asia, and these are areas where we're not seeing the progress we want on HIV and, in fact, backtracking, increased infection in some areas. So we really need the financing and we need the political will mobilized to get people what they need in those areas.
And we'll definitely talk about financing and even political will, but financing more so because there is a big gap. There is a major gap. Now, talking about the progress that we've made, we also, as both of you mentioned, we see with young women, for example, there is a problem. Do you think that complacency, given the gains, could be perhaps one of the reasons that with all the gains that have been made, maybe there is complacency? Some people think maybe HIV is not as critical of a disease as it used to be. What can you say about complacency, Chris?
I think there's a couple places that we sometimes see complacency. One is among older people who've been, you know, living in a world with HIV for years and years, and it can get hard, I think, to maintain, you know, safer practices all the time. And so they, you know, they say, well, there's treatment now. You know, who knows? It maybe feel less of a problem to people. Many ways, that's a wonderful thing, right? Because we have these great treatments. But people still need to be protecting themselves. And the other place we see complacency is lawmakers. You know, there was real dedication among donor countries to fighting HIV for many, many years. And we've really seen that level off and some of that donor funding go elsewhere. So I think I don't know that there's complacency about young people. These are people who face a whole lot of opportunities and challenges in their lives. It's our responsibility to make sure they have access and education so they can protect themselves and get the care they need.
Okay, Megan, would you like to react on the complacency?
Yeah, I would completely agree. I don't see the complacency around this type of health needs with young people at all, but I do absolutely see it when we're talking about needing funding for a lot of our supportive services, our prevention services, you know, services that cost money to keep someone close at hand and make sure that they're coming in and getting the care that they need. And everybody says, well, doesn't insurance cover that? Or is HIV still a problem in the United States? Or even, is it still a problem globally? And we're constantly not just having to educate and re-educate our young people about sexual health, but we're needing to educate, like you said, the lawmakers, the funders, the policymakers. And so I think that that is absolutely somewhere that we need to start. What the only place that I would even maybe see complacency is around not understanding that services for young people need to be different than services for old people. We can't just be complacent with our HIV education and the way that we do things. We have to continuously pivot and realize that young people are not just miniature adults, and the needs that they have are different than what adults have.
Wow, that's a good point, definitely. And we will continue this very interesting discussion with our guest, Chris Collins, friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and Megan Davis with the Whitman Walker Health. And we will be right back in a few minutes, but first, the news with Ruth Adisu.
Good evening. New data at the International AIDS Conference 2018 reveals a significant $6 billion gap between what is available for response and what is needed. Now to ensure global access to prevention, treatment, and care. In a report released recently titled Miles to Go, Closing Gaps, Breaking Barriers, Righting Injustices, UNAIDS stresses that achieving the 2020 targets would be impossible if investments from both donor and domestic sources were to increase. The United Nations AIDS Agency says global new HIV infections declined by just 18%, and decline was not quick enough to reach the target of fewer than 500,000 by 2020. A new joint UNICEF World Health Organization report indicates that newborns who are put to their mother's breast within the first hour of life are more likely to survive, while those left to wait face life-threatening consequences. The report titled Capture the Moment shows that 3 in 5 babies that are not breastfed in the first hour of life. That's around 78 million newborns that miss out, putting them at risk of death, disease, and making them less likely to continue breastfeeding. The report urges governments, donors, and decision makers to adopt strong legal measures to restrict the marketing of infant formula and other breast milk substitutes. And that's a wrap-up of your latest health news. Lenore, back to you.
Thank you, Ruth. And welcome back for those of you joining us late. Tonight, we take a look at the fight against HIV/AIDS with my guest, Chris Collins, president of Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and Megan E. Davis, chief of operations and program integration at the Whitman Walker Health. Chris Collins, $6 billion cap. Where do we find the money?
Well, I think it needs to come from all the stakeholders involved, and I think all of us in this world have a stake in ending AIDS. So I would say, all of us need to be playing a role there. Certainly, domestic investment by those countries that are most heavily affected needs to increase. But we have to remember that domestic investment by countries, for example, in Africa and Asia and elsewhere, has really gone up markedly in the last 10 years. It's up 60% over the last 10 years, that what countries are investing in terms of grappling with their own HIV epidemic. So right now, actually, 62% of what is spent on HIV comes from those domestic sources. So that's a pretty good start. We need to build on that. We need more domestic investment. You also need to remember that in the countries that are most affected by HIV, where the incidence is highest, they tend to be far more dependent on international aid. So any loss or lack of increase, frankly, in what donors give are going to hurt those countries most affected most acutely. On the donor side, we have seen recent declines overall in donor giving. The United States, thankfully, has remained flat in its investment in HIV, both through the PEPFAR program and through its funding of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria. So that's good. One of the major opportunities for policymakers all over the world in terms of AIDS financing is the replenishment conference for the Global Fund, which is coming up in 2019. We really want to see an increase in overall donor pledges to the Global Fund this time because, first of all, the need is there in terms of fighting AIDS, TB, and malaria. But also, we have shown great results when the investment's been there and we've gone to scale, as I said. So I think replenishment for the Global Fund, a huge opportunity. And just in general, I think donors really need to assess, are we ready as a world to let AIDS, you know, become more severe again and not and have this epidemic with us for decades? We have the opportunity to bring the AIDS epidemic to an end in the coming years. We need to take that opportunity and invest wisely.
Megan, any reaction with regards to funding, especially with the work that you do at the clinic?
Yeah, absolutely. For us, obviously, it's very different than globally. One of the big places is the Ryan White Care Act. There's often conversations about cutting it or limiting it and possibly even people saying that there's no longer a need for it given how well we're doing with the fight against HIV. But again, like Chris said, we are at a point in time where we can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and are we going to continue to push forward, or are we going to say, well, you know, good is enough? So we need to continue to make sure that the Ryan White Care Act continues in the United States. And then also private donors. So that is one of the places where we get to do the extra stuff that I mentioned. And for years, because people felt so connected to the HIV epidemic, we had a large amount of private donors, and that those numbers are declining every year. We see our private donations declining. We have a walk every year, a walk to end HIV in the District of Columbia. It's a place where you can come, you can see people who this has affected, and it's an amazing place to be with community, and it's also an amazing place to donate your money, and we're able to then do those, kind of, like I said, those special services. You know, that's where we do the peer education, the outreach. We've got a leaders in training program to support young people being leaders and taking control of their sexual health and that narrative. And so we ask for donors to just continue to support the fight against HIV because I really think it's a good place to put your money.
So it's really about tackling the sense of donor fatigue.
Absolutely.
Yes. So, I mean, there have also been a concern about a cut in funding from the United States. And Chris, could you address that? How is that affecting the funding?
Well, the president has now, for the last 2 years, proposed pretty big cuts to both our PEPFAR program, our bilateral AIDS program, and to the U.S. contribution to the Global Fund. And, you know, those kinds of cuts would be truly devastating, really, meaning that a lot of people wouldn't be getting services to save their lives, that we'd really be kind of enabling the epidemic to get out of control again. Fortunately, the U.S. Congress has really asserted leadership here and rejected those cuts and maintained funding for the PEPFAR program and the U.S. contribution to the Global Fund. In fact, the Senate is actually proposing a $50 million increase for PEPFAR this year. So we've been really gratified and thankful for the leadership of people like Senator Lindsey Graham and Senator Leahy, Chairman Rogers, and Ranking Member Lowy for making sure on their appropriations bills that we protect global health, we don't cut it. But again, looking at what we're facing with HIV, where we've got great tools, we just need to bring them to scale, this is a time to seriously consider increasing that investment because we are seeing affected countries do more, and they need to continue to do more. But U.S. funding for global health and for AIDS has been flat for about 7 years. So it is really time to reassess that and say for the own interests, for the interests of the United States, it's time to look at that investment and increase it.
So Megan, let's talk about messaging, because when we talk about prevention and awareness, is there a problem with regards to the way the messages are conveyed in specific target population? What is your experience?
Sure. I think there's two different problems that we often see. One is, in my opinion, around fear. and trying to make people afraid of HIV and thus afraid of sex. And that is just not a good message, especially for young people, but anybody. Sex is not something to fear. Sex is something to cherish. And it is fun, and people know that. It is good for the body and the soul, but it is also important to know how to protect yourself. And so, again, if you go at it in fear, then young people are going to ignore you, and they're going to do what they want to do. And we want to make sure that we give them the tools to do it right. The second place with messaging where I think that we make a lot of mistakes is around showing people that don't look like me. They're not from my community. They don't understand what I'm going through, and therefore, why should I follow that message? That isn't me. And so really making sure that it's a diversity of messages, that it's targeted, that it's in the proper languages, that it's at the right sites. And again, it, like I mentioned earlier, making sure that we pivot, that we don't just think one message fits all. One condom doesn't fit all. One message doesn't fit all. And so making sure that we are able to really diversify that.
And speaking of messaging, Chris Collins, as advocates, what is the message that you convey out there to donors, to people to get more involved?
I think the first thing that we talk about, particularly when we're talking to U.S. lawmakers, is just the terrific results. And, you know, what we've seen from this U.S. and other country investment in fighting HIV. Again, where we've really reached a lot of the people in need, we've seen HIV incidence plummet. We've seen HIV mortality plummet. So the first thing we tell lawmakers is your dollars are making a huge difference. They're saving life every single day. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the environment we're in today in the United States, and I think probably in a lot of other countries, it's also important to talk about how a country's investments in fighting AIDS globally really benefits that country too. So we do try to let lawmakers, you know, help them think about that, how, for example, the U.S. investment in the Global Fund and PEPFAR really helps us build great, better diplomatic relationships with other countries, helps us in terms of our trade relationships, mm-hmm. certainly helps in terms of engendering security, more secure societies, but in addition, health security. You know, as everyone knows, viruses don't respect borders. So, you know, our investment in HIV and in malaria and TB and other areas of global health are helping increase the health infrastructure in countries so that next Ebola or that next Zika virus can be dealt with swiftly and contained and doesn't hopefully affect other countries. So, you know, I think the donor investment in HIV is an investment in saving lives, but it's also a communal effort to bring one of the most horrible epidemics of our time to an end and to also protect our own countries.
And we just ended the International AIDS Conference last week. What do you see as the big takeaway, Chris Collins?
I think the AIDS community is celebrating the success it's seen in many places, but also really coming to grips with the painful reality that we are falling short in many others and that we are not on track right now to end this epidemic, even though we could be. So I think people are frustrated. They're committing to redoubling their advocacy efforts. We need lawmakers all over the world, both in donor countries, but also in countries that are heavily affected by HIV, to hear the message about what can be done if they invest mm-hmm. and if they have good policies that help people most at risk reach services. They need to understand the great potential that is out there. Right now, we haven't been as successful as we need to be in getting that financing opportunity message to people. But I think a clear message from the conference is it's right to do that. We need to do that, and we need to redouble our advocacy.
Okay. And Megan, I will give you the last word. What do you hope to see moving forward? What are your hopes?
I think I just hope that we're re-energized. I think it is a new time. The future is ours. We can absolutely end HIV. We know how. We just need to start doing it.
Mm-hmm. And with your clinic, the service that you provide, what are your hopes?
We want to be a place where everybody feels welcome. We want people to know that they can come here and feel loved and cherished for the work that that they do in their communities, and we honor their lives, and we really hope that people feel that way here, and that we get to stop HIV. You know, we're very lucky to be in a city that is very progressive, that really cares about the community, and we want to continue to do that work. But like Chris said, there continues to be more work to do.
Fantastic. Megan Davis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Chris Collins, I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us in the studio. And to all the listeners, that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. We thank today's guest, Chris Collins, president of Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and Megan E. Davis, chief of operations and program integration at the Whitman Walker Health. For more on today's show, log on to our website at voanews.com and look for Health Chat, or you can keep the conversation going on facebook.com/voahealthchat. And I'm your host, Lino Mudu in Washington, with producer Danielle Brown, production assistant Thomas, Ruth Adisu with the news, and engineer Pete Hendley. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is VOA News. I'm Steve Miller. Suspect